I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are. People of color in restaurants and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
Welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Have you ever wondered why most grocery stores, despite the chain, more or less have the same floor plan, or why candy bars are always available at the cash register? The layout of stores and strategic placement of certain items is the result of a very purposeful decision-making process designed to encourage people to buy more of one thing over another. Often, the items for sale tend to be of a lower nutritional value, potentially helping to fuel these high levels of obesity and diet-related disease that we see very prevalent in our society today. But what if these strategies and subtle cues that influence all of our decision-making processes were used to promote healthy items instead? Join the show today to discuss the possibility of using behavioral economic-based interventions to lead food consumers of all ages to healthier diets is Dr. David Just, whose recent paper titled Influencing the Food Choices of SNAP Consumers, Lessons from Economics, Psychology, and Marketing, was just published in the Journal of Food Policy. Dr. Just is currently a professor and director of graduate studies in the Charles H. Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University. He serves as co-director of the Cornell Center for Behavioral Economics and Child Nutrition Programs as well. David's work uses the tools of psychology and economics to examine important ways in which misperception and emotion can drive economic decisions. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm so glad to have you to talk about these issues. Starting at the very beginning, super simple question. What's behavioral economics? Can you give us a definition?
A lot of people have different definitions of behavioral economics. I guess, to me, the best way to describe it is, you know, economics comes at things thinking about how people should behave to make the best decisions possible for their own well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And behavioral economics is a way of sort of looking at how people deviate from that, how people make mistakes, what sort of shortcuts they take in their decision making, and why?
And why? So it's not necessarily like the actual nudge itself, the product placement itself. It's looking at why people make these choices, as opposed to like the actual choice themselves or the actual like decision to put something somewhere.
What I guess as scientists, we're always interested in the why. We'd like to be able to predict the way people would behave in sort of different circumstances than we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
That usually starts by just documenting this is what we've seen, and it's interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that behavioral economic, these nudges currently exist? Are there certain examples where it's proven to be effective to steer customers towards something healthier?
Sure, and in this respect, there's a long history of this. Most people interact with this and they think about it as just plain marketing, right?
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
You walk into the store, and as you mentioned, those candy bars are always sitting right by the cash register, and you have to look at them, and you have to sit there and wait while you're in line looking mm-hmm. at the candy bars. And they do that because they tempt you over time, and they get you to think, you sort of break down.
Your
level of willpower is defeated eventually.
Yeah.
So just hopefully you don't have to wait too long in line, right, too often. But there are those that, where they place things so that you can see them, easily at eye level or reach them easily.
Mm-hmm.
All throughout the store, they've placed things in such a way that they're guiding you towards certain items.
And am I correct that those items tend to be of lower nutritional value, or was that an overreach on my part?
I guess I'd say they tend to be. I don't know that there's any, there's nothing that says it has to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
But in a grocery store, the space and the displays, they're paid for by the food manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And the food manufacturers, they tend to not be associated with produce, right? The produce is not a branded item usually. So it tends to be the less healthy things.
Right. They're the prepackaged goods that a big CPG company wants to move.
Yeah.
So your focus, the focus of this paper looked specifically at SNAP recipients and how to encourage SNAP recipients to make healthier decisions. Why? Can you actually first give us a background on what you can and can't buy with SNAP? And then I want to know a little bit more about why this particular population was the focus of this research.
Sure. So the way SNAP works, recipients get an allotment of money. It's usually once a month. And that money can be spent only on food.
Mm-hmm.
And basically any type of food you can think of aside from, hot prepared meals. Although they've made some exceptions to that now. But for the most part, it's, anything that's food.
Mm-hmm. And then why why this population that you chose to look at, or that
sure.
that is of particular interest in moving the needle on their decision making process towards healthier items?
So I guess there are a few things that that got me interested in this. One, just some of the questions that got me into looking at applying behavioral economics to food in the first place
mm-hmm.
was motivated by thinking about food assistance programs. And the reason for that, first off, that's where the government has a whole bunch of levers they can press in terms of trying to change the diet. But also, there's been this sort of debate bubbling for quite a while about, obesity is quite a problem in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And for a time, it looked like obesity was really pretty closely associated with having a low income, and we know that diets of those lower incomes are of a lower quality,
mm-hmm.
and so there are a lot of people who've tried to say SNAP is the solution, and we should revise SNAP so you can't buy just anything. You shouldn't be able to buy soda. I think that was proposed at one point in New York.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't be able to buy soda on SNAP, or you shouldn't be able to buy this, that, or the other. On the flip side of that debate, there are a whole bunch of people who work in hunger generally who worry about those types of policies creating stigma and leading leading potential recipients to just drop out or not take advantage of this program and perhaps be in worse circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So with that sort of debate going on, the appeal of a behavioral policy that could encourage people to take healthier food while not restricting, you know, specifically them away from the less healthy foods that they like to indulge in might be appealing.
Might be like a happy medium between those.
Yeah.
So, okay, sorry. Did I, you go on?
No.
I have a tendency to cut people off sometimes. full disclosure. I mean, what else about SNAP recipients? Like, is there something different about what this population looks like in terms of their dietary choices? Or did you say that, you know, studies have kind of more recently shown that their diet is fairly on par with that of a, you know, of a non-SNAP recipient?
So there are two different types of studies out there. It depends a little bit on what you're trying to look for, what you find.
Yeah,
or not.
That's true. Yeah.
Those that look at, you know, whether they're getting the nutrition that they need, they find a pretty big improvement for those who are on SNAP. On the flip side, they also have more access to low nutrition items or junk foods, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you're getting a bit of both.
Right. So looking at this study, it seems like this would affect everybody. And so, you know, so how does that affect, you know, this study or how you're going to look at the results?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting question. So by law, it's not possible for grocery stores to discriminate between those who are on SNAP and those who are not, which means even if you were going to try and do something, specifically for SNAP recipients, if it's in a grocery store, it has to be something that really takes everybody in,
right?
And not just SNAP. So SNAP might be sort of the motivation behind it, but if we're going to try and encourage SNAP recipients to take more carrots, we're going to encourage everybody to take more carrots.
Right. It's just a benefit, actually.
I would see it that way. I would hope others would too.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so you discussed the range of tools for employing some of these, you know, some of these interventions. Can you walk us through what a couple of those look like?
Sure. So, you know, the main tools within a grocery store, people go into a grocery store, and most grocery stores in the U.S. have you know, hundreds of thousands of items to choose from. And that's overwhelming in a way, so that it's very difficult for people to focus very much on their decisions. And they become somewhat more susceptible in that sort of, you know, option-rich environment towards guidance, from the environment. The biggest tools that we have are visibility and convenience. And so finding ways to make the healthier foods more prominent or making them more convenient for people to select in particular.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing, this particular paper we're talking about is really an exploration of the ideas, trying to take from the theories and what we know from other circumstances and look at what might be possible here, because not a lot of work has been done in this space looking at promoting nutrition specifically. And so we have to draw a bit on the marketing that's been used to help get us to eat all the junk food over the last several decades.
Yeah, you're going to take a book from a page from that playbook.
Exactly.
Yeah.
See if we can use those same sorts of tools and make them work for us.
What would an example of, you know, convenience be? Would that be the point of sale, like the you know, items at checkout, kind of changing what is available there? Is that an example?
Sure. And there was a wonderful experiment run by some of my friends down in Mexico State, where they got some grocery stores to package, four vegetables or fruit, it's something that was really sort of convenient, and place them by the checkout counter where you usually would have candy bars.
Mm-hmm.
And they found a reasonable size effect on selection because it's really visible and it's really convenient. You just pick up the pack and walk away. And again, it's there at the checkout counter, so you're sitting there sort of staring at it for a while.
And so you're like, okay, I got to have this. But even if it doesn't look as like, you know, I mean, I think a candy bar sort of sells itself, right? So is it just because it's delicious? And I happen to think that like carrots are delicious also, but they might not be as appealing. So, I mean, like, what is the, you know, how effective is visibility really when, you know, I guess how much does like a taste preference kind of come into it?
I think it plays a pretty substantial role. So I think you'd have a hard time putting, you know, Brussels sprouts there and getting them to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But if you choose your produce wisely, something that you know would be appealing to just sort of pick up and eat, or things that you know induce a flavor that people find appealing,
like an apple, for instance.
Yeah, an apple, plums, something. Yeah, bananas. Those would all be very, very easy to see working in that sort of environment because people do find them appealing. They like them.
Mm-hmm.
They have the same sort of quality. It may not be a candy bar, but it's often that direction.
Right. What are some of the other, we started to touch on these. What are some of the other proposed interventions from a policy perspective that have been, you know, tried or suggested to improve the diet of, you know, SNAP recipients? And where, in your opinion, did they fall short? So, for instance, like, I mean, a lot of them, for instance, kind of, you know, focus on restriction. Of course, there is no restriction. You know, you can pretty much buy whatever you want food-wise from SNAP, like we talked about earlier. But I'm just wondering, you know, what is the kind of backlash or negative effects that some of these proposed interventions have had?
So, for those that try and bar a certain category of foods, the backlash tends to happen at the policy proposal level. I guess the way I'd say it is, we haven't implemented them to be able to see what the actual effects would be.
Right.
So we can't say too much about that. On the other hand, there have been some other policies that have been tried.
Mm-hmm.
There was a large sort of randomized control trial with incentivizing people to buy fruits and vegetables. I believe this was done up in Massachusetts, and it was very successful in the fact that it did get people who were receiving the incentive to buy more fruits and vegetables. They'd essentially get, you know, if they went through and they were purchasing fruits and vegetables, they would get a certain amount back in their food stamp benefit or SNAP benefit.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to purchase more down the line. And you did. You saw an increase. The increase was, I guess, significant from a statistical point of view, and it was modest in terms of its actual size.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was something that I think you would care about, but at the same time, it wasn't something that shook the earth.
Yeah. Well, I guess not, because, you know, there haven't been really substantive changes made to this program, you know, in quite some time. Okay, so we talked about, you know, how, like, what some of these basically might be. Can you tell me a little bit about, like, certain considerations that need to be, you know, thought through in advance of trying to roll out a program that changed, you know, that like was focused on using behavioral economic interventions on improving diet?
Sure. I guess to me, there are a few considerations. First and foremost, it's a new space for us, and so it's something where we need the research to be able to see what actually changes consumers' behaviors.
Right.
But beyond that, it's a space where, you know, as I said, food manufacturers are paying for space and for visibility, and you know, grocery stores really do depend on that in some sense. So we've got to make sure we're doing this in a way that is appealing to the retailer, to the grocery store manager, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it can't, you know, do away with their stream of income from the manufacturers that are paying for space and visibility. And that means we can't really, you know, have huge negative impacts on those manufacturers either. It has to be measured. The other piece of that is, you know, the grocery store manager is driven by margins, right? And so some of the food items that are healthier in the store may have relatively low margins, and so it doesn't benefit them a whole lot to promote those. But others of them have relatively high margins. And so, in particular, fresh fruits and vegetables, because of the perishability, they end up having relatively high margins. And you can benefit the grocer tremendously if you can raise sales of those items relative to some of the more packaged goods.
But wouldn't so you're just talking about, you know, increasing volume of moving fresh fruits and vegetables.
Right.
I mean, how do you, like, honestly, what manufacturer is going to be supportive of this? I truthfully, right? So in my previous life, I was a consultant for a big CPG company who, like, was terrified of any restrictions being placed on, like, point of sale purchases, like what can and can't be sold at the point of sale in all kind of retail environments. And I'm sure would be committed to fighting it tooth and nail if that was ever proposed at, like, some sort of a policy level. So I'm a little skeptical about, like, manufacturers' motivation to get on board with this type of work.
So I think certainly if you're talking about a restriction, it's just dead in the water in terms of getting manufacturers and for that matter, the grocers on board. If, on the other hand, if there's the threat of that sort of action, something that's able to promote fruit and vegetable intake that doesn't directly negatively impact the manufacturers, the CPGs, you know, this might be acceptable,
but
right? It might not be something they're jumping up and down and cheering about, but it would at least be something that wouldn't necessarily harm them directly.
But wouldn't it, though? I mean, if people are going to be buying more of one thing over another, you know, I mean, I don't know if the answer is people spend more money. I think that in today's world, that is probably not likely to happen, right? People have, like, a fixed amount that they want to spend on groceries in particular. So wouldn't it still be kind of like taking away from, I mean, wouldn't sales inevitably decrease of the kinds of products that they're selling?
The economist in me tells me yes.
Yes.
That's probably what's going to happen and how it's going to end up. It's unclear from the initial studies whether that's how it works or not. I think that's what's going on, is that they're moving money from one part of the store to another.
Right. Okay. So it seems like it would be an uphill battle to get this, you know, this particular stakeholder on board. But maybe there's hope. I'm not a very optimistic person.
To me, it's just a read of the policy environment. If it really feels like this is the best of the, you know, of bad options to them, they might find it acceptable.
That's true.
If the alternative is do nothing, then yeah, they probably would push back.
That's a very good point. Okay, we're going to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. So stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group, or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
Welcome back to Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Dr. David Just, whose recent paper titled Influencing the Food Choices of SNAP Consumers, Lessons from Economic Psychology and Marketing, was just published in the Journal of Food Policy. Okay, so I have, another one of these great broad stroke questions for you, and that is, what is the key to success in a behavioral intervention like this?
That's a very good question. So a behavioral intervention has got to be, if we're trying to put in this as a policy of some sort, mm-hmm. it's got to be appealing to the people who implement it, right? Okay. So at the very first, question you need to ask, other than is it actually going to change consumers' behavior, the person who actually controls the lever, is this something that is beneficial for them or something they would be excited about, mm-hmm. right? Which is why those, when I start thinking about trying to look at nudges that will be beneficial health-wise and also improve the margins for the grocer, that's the first thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Got to be something that doesn't, kill the goose that lays the golden eggs for them. So that needs to be successful. Beyond that, it's got to be something that's relatively easy to implement. Otherwise, it won't. They'll never take the action.
Right.
And hopefully, it's something that has a long-lasting impact. For that reason, convenience really does seem to be one of the biggest. Convenience and visibility, like I said, are sort of the big keys. Because they can have a long-lasting impact where it's still just as convenient each time you go to the store. It's still in my line of sight, and so I think about it when I'm there instead of just forgetting about that item altogether.
Right. And I imagine the ability to replicate is something that you have to take in consideration also, or is that kind of tied up in what you just said?
Well, replication, I guess the way I'd say it is it's part of the process in determining whether it's a really an effective nudge or not.
So, go on.
Yep.
No, go on.
you run an experiment and one time out of 20, you're going to end up with something that looks like it solves all your problems, but it's just, it's random chance. Something odd happened. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That replication is really key in figuring out, sorting out, this is a real effect that we should worry about or it's not.
What can you actually, in talking about this, can you walk us through like how you would measure the effectiveness of this kind of intervention? So can you give us like an example of one of the interventions, one of the things you would like to see happen in an ideal world, and then how you would evaluate the success of that?
Sure.
In layman's terms.
So let's take take a simple example. Suppose I wanted to see if putting bunches of bananas within 6 feet of the register was going to increase banana sales,
mm-hmm.
right? Then the first step would be, what's our point of reference here? Usually we would look at store-level data. Because that would be easiest for something like that, and we'd want to enlist a whole bunch of stores and randomize them to either have those bananas within 6 feet of the register or to have them where they are normally, which is in the produce section.
Mm-hmm.
And then we collect the data, and we test that hypothesis. We see, well, were banana sales greater in those stores that had it within 6 feet or not? Right. That's ideally how you would first go about trying to test that.
What are examples of how this has worked in the past? I think a lot of the the work certainly that you've done or been associated with in the past has to do with school meals, school lunches. So
with school lunches, I guess the way I put it there is there was this desire from USDA that we find a suite of different strategies that could be useful for schools to try and encourage children to eat more fruits and vegetables. This was happening about, spanning the time when they were introducing new school lunch guidelines, and they were starting to have some noise about waste, about, we're putting all these healthy food in front of kids and they're throwing it away.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to find ways to get them to want to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there we put together a suite of different interventions, mostly taken from from direct interventions we'd made in schools. Some of them were things that were based on principles that have been around in behavioral marketing and food for a long, long time. But we introduced them and tested them in a school environment. But there again, it needs to be something where the school lunch manager is making the decision of whether to implement these things or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be easy for them. And it has to be something that that doesn't break their budget, because they have very, very tight budgets.
Right. And so, and this, you have done quite a bit of this work and seen a lot of success with it?
I'd say we've seen a reasonable amount of success with it. I wouldn't say everything we ever tried worked.
Right. Well,
But what we found is there are certain principles that, seem to have a regular effect where we've tried them.
Mm-hmm.
So finding ways to make it so that that the fruit is visible and convenient, and in particular, if you can find ways so that kids don't have to peel the fruit or cut the fruit or do something like that in order to eat it,
mm-hmm.
you get a lot higher consumption.
So, wow, that's really interesting. Okay, so switching back to policy, what would need to happen? What would like implementing something like this actually look like from a policy perspective?
For grocery stores.
For grocery stores, yes. Sorry, totally yeah. Changed tax there. Yeah, going back to the retail environment.
So, the grocer owns their environment, and I would guess there would be no support for the idea of, the government saying, okay, if you're going to do SNAP, you've got to put these nudges in place.
Yeah. I think that's probably right. I think your sense is probably accurate there.
Yeah. I don't think that would work. So what I would expect would happen is something along the lines of the government creating a short list or set of guidelines that they might recommend as best practices.
Mm-hmm.
And provide some sort of reward or publicity or certification or something like that to the retailer that implements some of these.
Okay.
So that it becomes something that's somewhat attractive for them. Maybe they get some publicity or advertising out of it. And it also reaches the consumers in a way that's positive.
So kind of like the Healthy Bodegas initiative that New York City implemented around 2010.
Yeah, I'd say that's actually a pretty good model for what might be done
at a larger
on a larger scale.
Like so many things that we did at the city during the Bloomberg administration from a public health perspective. It's a shameless plug for the work that we used to do.
It was a very, very active administration. I think we learned a lot from it.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly. I mean, and you talk about like the soda there. I mean, that came out of the administration also proposing a pilot program where soda was not allowed to be purchased with SNAP dollars. So that didn't go through. But I think all of these initiatives maybe got people thinking a little bit more about how to, you know, what can possibly be done to change the default or with the portion size, for instance, the portion size restriction on sugar-sweetened beverages, or help encourage healthier decision-making processes. Okay, so one of the things I am wondering about is that, you know, a lot of your research, obviously, this is focused on in-store behavioral changes and opportunities, but people more and more are shopping online, obviously, and this actually includes food, which I think is like a little bit of a change from certainly where we were a few years ago. So more, you know, broadly speaking, how does this, you know, change in the landscape affect your research? And can you, is it a whole other set of tools that must be employed to nudge people in certain directions?
That's actually a great question. And there are a lot of studies that have been done over the last few years trying to look at how effective nudges are for online grocery shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to say, I've seen results that are all over the board.
Yeah.
So some that, you know, basically most of these test by trying to bring up food items that are healthier and suggest them in place of what you might already be deciding to purchase, or making sure you have some fruit and vegetable that shows up on the page that you first land on, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that the literature has settled down any bit in trying to determine which of those are most effective and which aren't. We actually just finished a study in Australia, and actually school cafeterias there have gone to a system where you order online, you pre-order online.
Hmm.
And we were trying to see if making the fruits and vegetables prominent on that menu was going to change things. And oddly, we found nothing.
Really?
Yeah. There's no movement whatsoever.
Why do you think that was?
We're trying to figure that out, and it's sort of hard to guess exactly what's going on. We know that there's an in-school fruit and vegetable program, a snack program, that was very effective. It might be that we've hit a ceiling, and so people aren't doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, to be honest. It'll probably require another study.
It's always room for another one. I mean, I wonder, I don't know, I'm thinking out loud here, which is, you know, always dangerous on air, but I wonder, like, if a government, when we talk about, like, policy and, you know, maybe what is an agency's role, for instance, in getting creative with how we encourage people to eat healthier foods, you know, I wonder if part of the role of the government could be funding for, you know, for some of these like fruits and vegetable, like producers or whatnot, to be able to kind of not like lobby, but, you know, increase like the visibility of their items, especially online. You know, you talk about landing pages, like to be able to, fund some of that work to kind of level the playing field with what happens in industry right now.
It would be interesting to me to think about ways to do that. I mean, some of what I was talking about earlier with, you know, what are called slotting fees, the payments that the manufacturers make for visibility and things like that, it's a different landscape, because when you start talking about fruits and vegetables, you might be talking about farmer cooperatives, but you're
right.
Seldom talking about a corporate interest that is, you know, fighting tooth and nail for visibility and placement within the store.
Right.
It would be very interesting to see if there aren't ways to encourage a change in that landscape so that it was sort of on an even playing field.
Yeah, yeah. Food for thought, maybe, for those policymakers out there. We only have time for one more question, but I want to know, in your opinion, so you have focused on food in your career largely. Is there any other, you know, industry where you see, you know, industry or even maybe outside of like these nutrition programs within the food industry where you see like an area just like ripe for where this kind of behavioral economic interventions can be applied?
The next one that I think would be important would be sort of consumer environmental behaviors generally,
mm-hmm.
right? So people's willingness to recycle or compost or things like that, or people's willingness to reuse items or use them in the correct way so that you don't have negative environmental impacts.
Yeah.
I think that's a place where a lot of this, this same style of intervention could have an impact.
That is, I agree. And, I think that I would love to see that happen sooner rather than later.
Nice.
Well, yeah. Well, David, we have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so, so much for joining me on the show and talking about your new article.
Yep, thank you.
Great. One last thing. Where can our listeners go for more information on the work that you have done in the past and that you're continuing to do?
So, two places I would send you. One is smarterlunchrooms.org.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably the most readable set of information you can find out there. But there's also the Ben Center website, which is, I'd have to remember exactly what it is.
No, that's okay. Where they can just look into Google, what was the center?
It's the Center for Behavioral Economics and Child Nutrition Program.
There you go. All right. Okay, David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support. Show music is by the very talented Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.